that the Americans didn't learn about it.
Because there was an unwritten...
در مقابل
مخالفت
انگلیس.
امروز
در مورد
شرایط
the Shahs.
That also has talked to a number of people.
Mohammad Reza Shah had a tough time during the mid-1978. He was straining every nerve to keep his relations with the Carter administration. But the United States didn't seem to grasp the gravity of the situation in Iran.
I don't know enough about Jimmy Carter's mindset. Maybe Gary Sick does. I mean, I don't know if Jimmy Carter really said to himself, if we got rid of the Shah of Iran, everything would be terrific in Iran, because we'll bring about a democratic, libertarian, you know, secular government. Or whether Jimmy Carter didn't realize what he was saying, or thought that the Shah was so strong and powerful a character like Ferdinand Marcos, that this stuff would go over big in the United States, but it wouldn't matter to the Shah. The latter is my guess, is that Carter had no understanding of how weak the Shah was.
I was the person that was responsible for reporting to the President of the United States about what was going on. I wasn't the only person, but I was the principal. That was my job. And I wrote memos saying, you know, there are demonstrations, there are problems, we're seeing signs that things are not going well, it doesn't seem to be getting better. But I do remember vividly in August of 1978, which was quite a long ways into it, though the biggest demonstrations hadn't happened yet, Ambassador Sullivan was on vacation and came home, and I took him into the White House to see Mr. Brzezinski, the National Security Advisor. And I was in the room with Brzezinski and Sullivan, and Sullivan said to him, you know, Brzezinski asked him, what's going on in Iran, and you know, what's the situation? And he said, don't worry about it. The Shah has it all under control, and you have nothing to worry about.
Set against such a drop, the Shah appointed Jafar Sharif Emomi as his prime minister. His close connection to the clergy had made him the successful candidate in a competition with more qualified rivals. The appointment was a desperate attempt to restore peace to the country. Winning the vote of confidence, Sharif Emomi told the parliament about his plan for national reconciliation. By September 1978, the Shah had changed his tune on public demonstrations. He called for martial law in the capital city of Tehran and other big cities. Demonstrations were proscribed, nighttime curfew was imposed, and arrest warrants were issued for opposition leaders. On September 8, 1978, the faint hope of reconciliation between the protest movement and the Shah's regime vanished when a great number of demonstrators were slaughtered near Jalle Square in Tehran. The day was called Black Friday.
Let's forget, he was pretty stupid during this period, too. Instead of going to his cherished allies for 30 years and saying, look, I've got a problem, he was attempting to deal with them in his own way. In fact, the guy he picked as Deputy Inspector General of Imperial Guard had been a Khomeini guy for 5 years, you know, or maybe 3 years, but he went straight to Khomeini. That's why the rapprochement with the religious leaders that he tried for in the spring of 78 didn't work. because the guy that was running it from his shop was running to screw it up on Khomeini's benefit.
I believe that the secret of understanding the Shah is to understand that, in fact, the Shah was a very weak personality who had a very low sense of self-worth, of self-esteem. He was not a powerful character. And the result of that was that he was, partially for good reasons, partially for not so good reasons, eternally fearful of being overthrown. I mean, one has to remember that his father was overthrown by foreign powers. One has to remember that he was the subject of an assassination attempt in which bullets actually entered his body. So that would make one pretty fearful of future assassination attempts. That was in 1949. One has to remember that in 1953, the United States overthrew Mossadegh with the cooperation of the British. Not quite clear what the role of the CIA was, what the role of the British was, but all that to the aside, and brought the Shah back to power. So if we were able to get rid of Mossadegh, we could probably get rid of the Shah. And he was always concerned about the fact that, in fact, he was not sufficiently important to America that he would be guaranteed to be kept in power.
The country had passed the point of no return. In a span of 4 months, from October 1978 to January 1979, momentous events happened just to accelerate the downfall of the Shah. The period was marked by widespread opposition, massive strikes, and demonstrations through the whole country. During this period of time, the Shah's men left the country one by one, and soon the Shah found himself alone, in deep depression, and under the world's media spotlight. This time, the United States seemed to be a fair-weather friend of the Shah.
The Shah came to the United States for medical treatment in what have been, I guess, late 1979, early 1980, somewhere. Helms went to see him in the hospital in New York. And the first thing the Shah said to him was, "Why did you Americans turn against me?" So certainly by the time the revolution got underway, he had his doubts about us. And I think it affected his ability to manage the crisis.
Sharif Emomi began a policy of meeting the opposition's demands before being made. He did away with the unpopular Rastakhiz Party and announced all political parties in the country legal. Hundreds of political prisoners were released, and freedom of expression became a civil right. The Prime Minister also curtailed SAMAC's powers and closed down casinos and nightclubs. The imperial calendar was also abolished. During the heyday of the Rastakhiz Party, Mohammad Reza Shah once said, "The party will include all people of Iran, except those who are rebellious." Politically inept, the Sharif Emomi administration was unable to appease the angry opposition. And as for the Americans, they hadn't reached a consensus on what attitude they had to take towards the revolution. The disagreement between Brzezinski, Carter's national security advisor, and Cyrus Vance, the Secretary of State, was just a case in point.
Most Americans couldn't find Iran on a map if they tried. They have absolutely no idea what's going on in Europe in the last 300 years. Americans are very, very, very parochial. I mean, their greatest interest is who's winning the Super Bowl or the World Series right now, what's happening to their personal health insurance. They just don't have any real appreciation for foreign cultures of any kind. And it's not just the people. I mean, large numbers of people in the put into public office don't get it. You know, I had a colleague that went in to see George Bush reasonably after the election and spent 45 minutes of his hour with Bush trying to explain the difference between Sunnis and Shiites and came out tearing his hair. And this was a fellow that got elected president. There's just a very, very limited understanding of, foreign nations and cultures. We're a superpower by the fact that we're a super economic power and a super military power. We're not a superpower in terms of foreign understanding.
Problem was, you had a regime, an administration, I should say, Carter administration, that had deeply divided counsel about countries like Iran.
What they did do is bring in a guy by the name of Stan Escudero, who was a later ambassador to, I think, Azerbaijan and one other country in the Caucasus after the breakup of the Soviet Union. And Escudero was a kind of a controversial figure in the sense that he had been an outspoken critic in the mid-70s of our support, essentially of putting all the American national security eggs in the Shah's basket.
The third problem was that the American embassy in Tehran was woefully ill-informed about what was going on the street.
And Escudero was critical of that. But it almost terminated his career because it ran counter to what then Secretary of State Kissinger was advocating, the U.S. policy and the Ford and tail end of the Nixon administration. But he was also a fluent Farsi speaker. And so when the revolution happened, Sullivan asked for Escudero, or somebody like Escudero comes in, to infiltrate the crowds, which he does, specifically to try to get a sense of what the ground truth is with the demonstrators. And Escudero ends up reporting back repeatedly with Sullivan on, he meets religious leaders, he meets student leaders, he gets a very good sense of the opposition to the Shah, reports back to Sullivan, and essentially convinced with Sullivan's views that the Shah's done. This is a widespread opposition movement. It goes across not only religious, but all the stratas, you know, from the bazaar to the Gom and the religious movement, and even in elements within the military.
By autumn, popular support for the revolution was to the maximum. Those against the revolution preferred not to speak out. That's while some predicted that the victory would be achieved in November. On the 6th of November 1978, General Ghulam Reza Azhari succeeded Sharif Emami. A military government was the last hope.
A month later, General Azhari had a heart attack and he was in the hospital. And our ambassador Sullivan went to see him. While he was there, the general waved him over to his bedside and said, and he whispered in his ear, he said, "Yeah, the country is lost, for the king cannot make up his mind." And to me, I didn't hear about this until later, actually, but it is the single clearest description of the problem. The Shah had lots of assets at his command, lots of resources that he could use, and he couldn't make up his mind how to use them or to use them effectively.
On December 2nd, over 2 million people in Tehran took to the streets heading for Azadi Square. They called for the downfall of the Shah and the return of Imam Khomeini.
The time that almost everybody realized there was a problem and that maybe it had gone too far was at the time of the Ashwa-Teshwa riots in early December. News came out that they were going to have a massive demonstration. They said they were going to have it. The army threatened to stop it, and things were getting bad. And when the demonstrations took place, 1,200,000 people in the streets, and I did most of the count. I was experienced at Berkeley, where I used to count the demonstrators for the local press. About 1,200,000, no violence. And everybody concluded the Shah was gone.
A few days later, on December 10th and 11th, reportedly around 9 million people throughout the country staged large demonstrations. Even discounting for exaggeration, these figures may represent the largest protest event in history.
The world radically changed in 1979. I mean, even independent of the Iranian Revolution, you had the start of an Islamic century. You had the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, which ultimately showed that a small sort of religious power could, in fact, challenge militarily a superpower and win. So the whole way the world was being perceived changed, and one key piece of it was the Iranian Revolution. So sort of nobody knew how to deal with this. We didn't. The Russians didn't. So the world radically changed in this very critical year of 1979.
By mid-December, the Shah's position had deteriorated to a point that he wanted only to be allowed to stay in Iran. But he was turned down by the opposition. In late December, he agreed to leave the country temporarily, and still, he was turned down. On January 16, 1979, the Shah and his wife left Iran.
Do you expect the Shah to return to Iran? And if so...
This is up to him.
Well, he says he's taking an extended vacation, and obviously he's leaving you with a lot of problems to try to solve. And
well, there's a power to ruin the country, too.
In the end, it was the Shah who was responsible, in the sense that I think he came to believe that the greatest obstacle to his realizing his great ambitions for his people, the country of Iran also, were the Iranian people. And if it weren't for them, everything would be great. Well, it's pretty hard for a king to stay in power when he thinks his people are the obstacle to the realization of his dreams to make a great country.
Scenes of spontaneous joy followed, and within hours, almost every sign of the Pahlavi dynasty was erased. February 1st, 1979, Ayatollah Khomeini returned to Iran in a chartered Air France Boeing 747. The welcoming crowd of several million Iranians was so large that he was forced to take a helicopter after the car he was being transported in from the airport was overwhelmed by an enthusiastic crowd. Now, the undisputed leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Khomeini, was greeted with cries of Khomeini, O Imam, we salute you, peace be upon you, and Islam, Islam, Khomeini, we will follow you.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
in the limelight.
With the discovery of some highly confidential and sensitive documents from U.S. President Joe Biden's former private office and his home in Wilmington, Delaware, once again concerns about endangering American national security have increased. The majority of the American people expressed concern that the secret documents that Biden and former President Donald Trump illegally kept in their homes could potentially endanger some sources and methods of the American intelligence community. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. NBC News has covered this story and tells us more. A new survey has found that Americans are equally concerned about classified documents found in possession of President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump, even though the current and former presidents have handled their situations differently. An opinion poll released recently says 67% of respondents said they find the discovery of the Biden documents either very concerning or somewhat concerning, while an identical 67% held the same views about the discovery of the Trump documents. More than a dozen classified documents have been found at Joe Biden's residence and private office, while over 300 classified documents were recovered from Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence in Florida. Joe Biden and his lawyers claim they have so far cooperated with the Justice Department and allowed authorities to search his Wilmington, Delaware home, where six additional classified documents were found. However, Donald Trump resisted handing over the documents despite repeated requests from the National Archives and a subpoena, leading a judge to issue a warrant authorizing the FBI to search Mar-a-Lago in Florida. According to the survey, 50% of the respondents disapprove of Joe Biden's job performance compared to 45% who approve. The survey also found that Americans are also concerned that the handling of the classified documents by Biden is consuming Republican members of Congress. 55% of respondents said they believe House Republicans spend too much time investigating Biden rather than focusing on other priorities. 54% of respondents said they believe Republicans will be too inflexible in their investigations. In the wake of the discovery of the documents in both Biden's and Trump's possession, the Justice Department told the Senate Intelligence Committee that it was actively working to brief lawmakers about the potential risk to national security. Assistant Attorney General Carlos Uriarte wrote in a letter to a number of senators that prosecutors on both matters are actively working to enable sharing information with the committee. However, both Republican and Democratic senators voiced frustration after they left a recent closed-door briefing with National Intelligence Director Avril Haines, who declined to show them copies of the classified documents. The Sputnik News Agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to a Redfield and Wilton Strategies poll, a total of 43% of U.S. citizens believe the classified documents that were found in President Joe Biden's home and former office were probably deliberately kept by him and or his staff. Meanwhile, 34% of those sampled think that the classified documents were kept there probably mistakenly, with another 23% undecided. The opinion poll also found that 32% of the respondents believe the story has been overblown. A further 65% of those polled are in favor of searches of all of Biden's properties by the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI. The survey was conducted from 28th to 29th of January among 1,500 eligible voters. On 9th of January, U.S. media reported that Joe Biden's personal attorneys discovered 10 classified documents pertaining to Ukraine, Iran, and the United Kingdom at his think tank's office, prompting a federal probe into the matter. Several new packages of classified official papers have been discovered in Joe Biden's personal home in Wilmington, Delaware, since then. The U.S. Department of Justice is investigating how classified documents relating to the period of Biden's vice presidency ended up in office and residential premises not authorized for their storage. Republican House members have charged U.S. authorities of hypocrisy when it comes to the handling of the classified documents by President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump after leaving office. Representative James Comer, Republican of Kentucky, the newly appointed chairman of the House Oversight and Accountability Committee, recently called Biden's Delaware residence a crime scene. James Comer said, "My concern is that the special counsel was called for, but yet hours after that, we still had the president's personal attorneys who have no security clearance still rummaging around the president's residence, looking for things. I mean, that would essentially be a crime scene, so to speak, after the appointment of a special counsel." Republicans have criticized the response of U.S. authorities to the discovery, calling it hypocritical that Donald Trump's home was raided for the documents where Joe Biden's was not. Representative James Comer, Republican of Kentucky, said, "Joe Biden used as his closing argument during the midterm elections that Republicans were a threat to democracy, and he cited the fact that President Trump mishandled the classified documents. While he was doing this, he knew very well that he himself had possession of classified documents." He added, "So the hypocrisy here is great. We're very concerned about a lack of transparency. We're very concerned, as I have said many times, about a two-tiered system of justice in America. And we just want equal treatment. And hopefully we will get some answers very soon." The Associated Press has also covered the same story. The Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, has conducted a search of U.S. President Joe Biden's beach house in Rehoboth, Delaware, as part of a probe into his handling of classified documents. On Wednesday, 1st of February, search by FBI agents is part of an investigation to track down more improperly stored classified documents. Joe Biden's personal attorney, Bob Bauer, claimed the search was planned with the president's support. It was carried out without advance public notice in the interest of operational security and integrity. Joe Biden's personal lawyer, Bob Bauer, said the U.S. Justice Department did not find documents with classified markings during the 3.5-hour search of Joe Biden's house, but did take some materials for further review. According to Reuters news agency, classified materials were previously found at his home in Wilmington, Delaware, and at a Washington office, which he used during the time between his service as vice president under Barack Obama and his presidential election. The new probe is part of a wider investigation into the discovery of a trove of classified materials in Joe Biden's private office and the Florida residence of former President Donald Trump. Records from each administration are supposed to be turned over during a presidential transition period. It is unlawful to knowingly remove or retain classified material. The Justice Department has appointed a special counsel to investigate Joe Biden and Donald Trump's handling of sensitive government documents as they're both preparing for the 2024 election. Assistant Attorney General Carlos Uriarte wrote in a letter to a number of senators that prosecutors on both matters are actively working to enable sharing information with the committee. We'll be right back.
Hidden Files. I grew up in the United States with a counting song that went like this. One little, two little, three little Indians, four little, five little, six little Indians, seven little, eight little, nine little Indians, 10 little Indian boys. Now this was supposed to be a song for kids to learn how to count. And the other part of it is they dive in the boat and the boat turns over, 10 little, nine little, eight little Indian boys, and continues. If one thinks about what is being said, it is shocking, but as a kid, I just mimicked the lyrics like the other kids, not realizing the overall effect. I also grew up being shown Indian savages on westerns and how the poor white man just wanted to live in peace and develop the land that he had discovered. But the Redskins would not let them live in peace. This is the other process, meaning dehumanizing people. And these are just two examples of the way the original inhabitants of North America, the natives, were demonized and discounted, even up to this day in what is now the United States. From the time the European colonizers stepped foot on that land, the white man saw the natives as less than themselves. They were less human, less smart, less civilized, less deserving, which led to the invaders being able to forcibly remove and exterminate much of the original population of the land a lot easier. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. Today we will be looking at the original inhabitants of North America, the natives. I am Marzia Hashimi. Welcome. Well, the natives had lived on that land for tens of thousands of years. In 1492, when Columbus actually landed there, there were 112 million indigenous people. 112 million indigenous people. Keep that number in mind, because as we fast forward and we go to 1650, we have gone from that number of 112 million to 6 million people. Imagine that, by 1650. Unfortunately, the tragedy is so multifaceted. We look at then from between 1776 to 1887, and 1.5 billion acres of native land was stolen. This is the story, only part of the tragedy of the natives. Well, from being free to roam and live on over a billion acres to being forced to live on reservations, this became the reality for most natives who didn't die at the hands of the colonizers. Reservations were set up by the whites to control the native population, while at the same time more of their land could be stolen, Harsh measures were implemented, and brainwashing and miseducation were techniques used, as well as the Christianization of the natives on the reservations. Now, the land that the Europeans forced the natives to live on usually was not as fertile as the land they were used to having, or was the type of terrain that they were not familiar with. And many different tribes were thrown together on a reservation, not giving thought to if they were friendly with each other or if the tribe was used to farming or not. We're going to look at the role reservations have played and continue to play in the oppression and attempted elimination of Native people with my first guest.
Bleak.
Oppression.
Small.
Small. They're beautiful and sad at the same time. It's beautiful because you're surrounded by people that are just like you. But it's sad because everything that affects big cities, whether it's drugs or alcohol or everything's magnified on a reservation. You see it up front, like in your face.
Sick. You know, there's alcoholism, there's abuse, there's a domestic violence. There's a lot of things that go on a reservation that really goes overlooked.
Just a compromise. It was an agreement based, well, forced agreement probably, that Native Americans were put kind of out of the way, out of sight.
Yeah. Prison. It's like where we're trapped.
What do you think is the most common misconception about reservations?
That there's some kind of abundance, that Natives are happy, that they're caring for each other, that they live in some ancient way.
Ooh, sad.
Poor.
A concentration camp. Reservations were made to isolate Indian people and hope that we would die off.
Depressing.
Unfair, because they're not as good as other lands. They're the land that the government and people don't want.
Trapped? It wasn't great farmland, it wasn't great homeland, and so it kind of feels like a place off to the side.
Even to this day, the natives are fighting for rights, to keep the little what they have.
There are no good reservations. Here's your reservation. You can't go across that boundary. This is your reservation. And I grew up on a Navajo reservation, and we're one of the few lucky people that got to remain where our homelands are. But there are other reservations where people were forced there and they can't fend for themselves like they used to do in the old days. You can't hunt anymore, you can't fish anymore, because you're just stuck on a reservation on these substandard housing, living in third world country conditions. Youths killing themselves because there's no future, there's no hope. That's a reservation to me.
Very sad indeed, and one which hopefully makes us think of what Native Americans have gone through and what they're going through even right now at the hands of this white settler colonial entity. Well, let me get our first guest onto this program to give us a first-hand perspective of all of this.
Juan B. Mancius, the tribal chairman of the Carrizo Comecrudo tribe. Juan is the eldest born to a lineage of hereditary chiefs of the Carrizo Comecrudo, but also descends from the Tasuki Pueblo and Kikapu nations. He has held leadership roles as an assistant tribal administrator with the Kikapu Traditional Tribe of Texas and the tribal administrator of the Scotts Valley Band of Pahwa Indians of California and the Alabama Coushatta Tribe of Texas. Today, Juan focuses on decolonizing both tribal people and others. He has written a 12-step decolonization program and presents it frequently at conferences and seminars.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. Welcome to Hidden Files. Can you tell us about the role reservations played in oppressing the natives?
At the very beginning, I think a lot of the reservations that were set up were set to confine and to change our life ways to the lifestyles And there's a difference between those life ways and those lifestyles. Our life ways are our traditional values and our traditional beliefs compared to the ideals of lifestyles that was brought here by the colonization. And that became very oppressive because we were practically being brainwashed to change, to accommodate, the colonizers that were here. And so for a long time, I think, I know that a lot of our relatives were on other reservations were not allowed to leave the reservation without permission, and that's become commonly most of the undoing of losing a lot of our language, losing a lot of who we are. Of course, you know, then by doing that, they stole a lot of the land.
Well, what are other techniques used by the Europeans, in your perspective, to oppress the natives?
I think that for the longest time, the big oppression in this area has been, you know, the Spanish mission concept of coming in and trying to, they were cutting our hands and cutting our legs and, you know, hanging us and to try to, so those that didn't want to convert. And that happened throughout the Middle Americas, what is called Americas now. So there's a lot of oppression based on being forced to learn one language and to forget your language. The boarding school system was one of those. The missions of this area of the Southwest were another one of those. To the Southwest and through California, they were very oppressive to who you are, who we are, and they outlawed a lot of our ceremonies.
And I mean, what would you say are some of the main problems that natives still face today?
And that's what they did here with the doctrine of discovery. They said if we don't believe the way they do or live the way they do, that they could kill us. And that's what they did for a long time. And here in Texas, up until the 1940s, they were still killing us. And they were finding ways to take away the land, and that's how they did it. And there's still a high percentage of prisons that have a large percentage of people of color. That should tell you something too. But they still want to control what they're. And if you speak very loudly, you get. They'll find ways to get you. So, thing is that they like their system the way it is, and it's only for them. And for the rest of us are just supposed to suck it up, you know. And that's no longer the question here. I'm not here to make the white man comfortable anymore. I'm here to make my people comfortable. So.
And with that, we appreciate you being with us right here at Hidden Files. Well, stay tuned. We're going to welcome our next guest to the program right after this.
Terrence Nelson, Vice Chairman of the American Indian Movement. Terrence is also spokesman for the Oki-Ida Warrior Society. He's former chief of Roseau River Anishinaabe First Nation and has written numerous books and booklets.
Thank you so much for joining us here at Hidden Files. How are reservations still being used today in your perspective to repress natives?
Well, one of the things is that you can't pledge any lands, you don't have access to the banks because you can't pledge anything on a reservation land. You're denied access to the economy. So the United States, the indigenous peoples living on reservations are probably, you know, they're the most impoverished people because it's deliberately set out like that so that the indigenous people don't have the money to fight the system that they find themselves in. So it is it's economic repression.
Well, there are so many tragic events in Native history. One is the Trail of Tears, even significant by its name. Can you talk about this event and others that you think may even affect your people today?
Well, on the Trail of Tears, they just rounded them right up, and they force marched them to Oklahoma, but that was only one area where they ended up doing that. amongst the Dakotas of North Dakota, South Dakota, and they basically rounded up the people and they forced them onto reservations. And then when they didn't want to do that, like there was lots of different, I guess, highlights in history where the indigenous people fought back. That's why you have names like Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse, and those ones that, like Geronimo, and those ones that have come through history that fought back. They fought back, and they were just small groups of people most of the time. They didn't have a lot of weapons and guns and things like that. They basically fought back as best they could. And the United States Army was extremely well equipped. They had all kinds of manufacturing of Gatling guns. They had all kinds of cannons. They had they had mounted horses and armies and, fighting against people that were just essentially had to. They hauled their women and their children and their living, and they basically slaughtered all of the buffalo so that the indigenous people didn't have anything to eat. But there was those are things that people don't understand. Yeah, when you don't have anything to eat, when you have your children, you know, you're looking at your children that are starving, and you're trying to fight back. Well, that's what the indigenous people did. And that Trail of Tears you talk about, that's what they did. They essentially force marched them, and they fed them whatever little that they had, and then they basically just the indigenous people were falling off and they were dying. You know, it was because when you, as a parent or as a grandparent, and you see these little kids dying, you know, how horrible is that? People don't understand that. The policies even extended to the residential school area, they call it here in Canada, but on the American side, it was called the boarding schools, where you know, our Native Americans were essentially taken from their homes when they were 3, 4, 5, 6 years old, and taken to a school run by the churches and run by the, and they were forcibly indoctrinated into Christianity, and they were told that they were devil worshippers, these kids, that their parents were, you know, were heathens and everything else like that. So that's the way that they were taught. What's tragic right now is that the Native Americans and our people are, we don't know the true history of what happened to our people, because the one that controls history or the textbooks and the is the ones that essentially write the books, and it is the Europeans that wrote the books. So the Trail of Tears is not well known in the U.S. school system, and then they kind of come along and they tell these young white people that the Native Americans are dependent people, that they get their free money from the United States government and everything else like that. Meanwhile, nobody talks about all of the resources that are sold to keep the to subsidize the Native the American lifestyle. So the gold, the silver, uranium, platinum, oil, trees, water, everything that is now owned by the Europeans and sold to everybody else, they don't pay it to the indigenous people. They pay it to the corporations and to the governments that sell these products. But it was originally owned by the indigenous people.
Indeed, it is a sad story what happens and continues to happen to the indigenous people. Thank you so much. I appreciate you being with us. Well, I started off this program by talking about so-called poems and TV shows that ignore the humanity of the natives. And this is still a problem and is endemic of settler colonialism. When it is said that they, the white man, the European, discovered this nation and that they birthed a nation from nothing, These lies add to the facade of white supremacy. Now, the very roots of the United States were laid by Native and African genocide and displacement. When in its own constitution, Thomas Jefferson writes about the merciless Indian savages, how likely can we expect a change in the way Washington deals with the original people of that land? As violence is the foundation of white supremacy and imperialism is nourished by exploitation, it is more likely that viewing and treating natives as less than will continue. So it is the natives themselves who must continue to demand their rights and not remain silent. I end this program with a quote from a native chief, Hedmat Toyolakat, who said, "Let me be a free man, free to travel, free to stop, free to work, free to trade, where I choose my own teachers, free to follow the religion of my fathers, free to think and talk and act for myself, and I will obey every law or submit to the penalty. Otherwise, it seems that resistance is the only way." We will definitely be continually to bring you the latest on the natives. For now, though, that's goodbye for me and all the crew right here at Hidden Files. Thank you so much for being with us, and let us hear from you, from your corner of the world. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
In the limelight.
In the United States, New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu said on Sunday, 5th of February, he doesn't think former President Donald Trump could beat President Joe Biden in a 2024 rematch. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The American newspaper The Hill has covered this story and tells us more. Former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie and New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu, two prominent moderate figures in the Republican Party, both predicted on Sunday, 5th of February, that former President Donald Trump could not beat President Joe Biden if they were in a rematch for the White House in 2024. Both men are facing skepticism from their own parties, with Democrats calling Joe Biden too old to run for re-election and Republicans expressing desire to see another candidate to be their GOP nominee. An ABC Washington Post poll conducted over the last week showed that there was little enthusiasm for a rematch between Donald Trump and Joe Biden, with many voters in both parties hoping for a different choice. Donald Trump is expected to face opposition from a number of other candidates in the GOP, but Joe Biden has yet to garner any formal opposition from another Democratic candidate. When asked on ABC's This Week program by co-anchor Jonathan Karl whether Trump could beat Biden, Chris Christie said, "I don't think so." Governor Chris Sununu also said no when asked the same question earlier on the show, saying he thinks the former president Donald Trump would be seen as too extreme. "No, Trump is going to be seen as a very extreme candidate. The country is going to push back against it," Sununu said. "He could get the nomination, but he can't get it done." New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu is mulling a White House bid of his own. Chris Christie ran for president in 2016, but ended his campaign in February of that year after losing the New Hampshire primary. He then endorsed Donald Trump and advised his campaign to do the same. Chris Christie has since shared regular criticisms of Donald Trump since the former president left office. He also argued that other Republican candidates may be hesitant to declare their intent to run because no one wants to be at the center of attacks by Donald Trump. "Who wants to be the first in the poll with Donald Trump?" Chrissy said. "When he has no one else to shoot at, and his whole life is about shooting at people." The website Politico.com has also covered this story and tells us more. New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu said on Sunday he doesn't think former President Donald Trump could beat President Joe Biden in a 2024 rematch. "Unfortunately, at the end of the day, November of 2022 showed us that, right? Trump is going to be seen as a very extreme candidate. The country is going to push back against it," the Republican governor said. New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu, speaking on ABC's This Week program, was responding to a question about a new Washington Post ABC poll that showed Donald Trump ahead of Joe Biden when it comes to the 2024 election. Sununu was not persuaded by those numbers. "It can't get done. He could get the nomination, but he can't get it done," Sununu said of the former president. New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu, who offered pointed criticisms of Joe Biden's handling of the economy, said Republicans need to nominate the most electable conservative that they can find. He said that a solid GOP field was shaping up and that he was also thinking about it when it comes to entering the race himself. "Definitely thinking about it, having those conversations," Sununu said, "but at the end of the day, you're going to have a lot of Republicans that get in that race. They're all really good people. They're really good candidates. You have Nikki Haley and Mike Pompeo and Governor Ron DeSantis and a lot of folks who are going to get in." Speaking later on the same program, former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie agreed with Chris Sununu that Donald Trump was unlikely to defeat Joe Biden. "I don't think so," he said during a panel discussion. The Washington Post ABC poll gave Donald Trump a 48-44 edge over Joe Biden, but it also showed that a majority of Democrats do not want Joe Biden to be the Democratic nominee in 2024, and that a plurality of Republicans feel the same way about Donald Trump. The opinion poll, released 2 days before Joe Biden's State of the Union address, was conducted between 27th of January and 1st of February, among a national sample of 1,003 U.S. adults, and has a margin of error of plus or minus 3.5 percentage points. The Business Insider has also covered this story and tells us more. New Hampshire Republican Governor Chris Sununu on Sunday said former President Donald Trump won't be able to defeat President